Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and I'm reading today from the story of John G. Peyton, missionary to the South Sea Island Cannibals, in islands formerly known as the New Hebrides, now the nation of Vanuatu. We're on chapter 59. It's called House Building for God. The site being now cleared, we question whether to build only a temporary home, hoping to return to dear old Tana as soon as possible, or, though the labor would be vastly greater, a substantial house, for the comfort of our successors, if not of ourselves. We decided that, as this was work for God, we would make it the very best we could. We planned two central rooms, 16 feet by 16, with a 5 feet wide lobby between, so that other rooms could be added when required. About a quarter of a mile from the sea and 35 feet above its level, I laid the foundations of the house. Coral blocks raised the wall about 3 feet high all around. Air passages carried sweeping currents underneath each room and greatly lessened the risk of fever. A wide trench was dug all around and filled up as a drain with broken coral. At back and front, the veranda stretched 5 feet wide, and pantry, bathroom, tool house were partitioned off under the veranda behind. The windows sent me had hinges, so I added 2 feet to each with wood from mission boxes and made them French door windows, opening from each room to the veranda. And so we had, by God's blessing, a healthy spot to live in, if not exactly a thing of beauty. The mission house, as ultimately finished, had 6 rooms, 3 on each side of the lobby, and measured 90 feet in length, surrounded by a veranda, 100 feet by 5, which kept everything shaded and cool. Underneath 2 rooms, a cellar was dug 8 feet deep and shelved all around for a store. In more than one terrific hurricane, that cellar saved our lives, all crushing into it when trees and houses were being tossed like feathers on the wings of the wind. Altogether, the house at Aniwa has proved one of the healthiest and most commodious of any that have been planted by Christian hands on the New Hebrides. In selecting site and in building, the good hand of our God was on us for good. I built also 2 small orphanages, almost as inevitably necessary as the missionary's own house. They stood on a line with the front of my own dwelling, one for girls, the other for boys, and we had them constantly under our own eyes. The orphans were practically boarded at the mission premises and adopted by the missionaries. Their clothing was a heavy drain upon our resources, and every odd and curious article that came in any of the boxes or parcels was utilized. We trained these young people for Jesus, and at this day many of the best of our native teachers and most devoted Christian helpers are amongst those who would probably have perished but for these orphanages. Every day after dinner, we set the bell ringing, intimating from our first arrival on Aniwa readiness to give advice or medicine to all who were sick. We spoke to them, so soon as we had learned, a few words about Jesus. The weak received a cup of tea and a piece of bread. The demand was sometimes great, especially when epidemics befell them, but some rather fled from us as the cause of their sickness and sought refuge from our presence in remotest corners or rushed off at our approach and concealed themselves in the bush. They were but children and full of superstition, and we had to win them by kindly patience, never losing faith in them and hope for them any more than the Lord did with us. Our learning the language on Aniwa was marked by similar incidents to those of Tana related in a preceding chapter, though a few of them could understand my Tanese, and that greatly helped me. One day a man, after carefully examining some article, turned to his neighbor and said, "Tahatine?" I inferred that he was asking, "What is this?" Pointing to another article, I repeated their words. They smiled at each other and gave me its name. On another occasion, a man said to his companion, looking toward me, "Taha Nego!" Concluding he was asking my name, I pointed towards him, and I repeated the words, and they at once gave me their names. Well, readers would be surprised to discover how much you can readily learn of any language with these two short questions constantly on your lips, and with people ready at every turn to answer, "What's this?" or "What's your name?" Every word was at once written down, spelled phonetically, and arranged in alphabetic order, and a note appended as to the circumstances in which it was used. By frequent comparison of these notes, and by careful daily and even hourly imitation of all their sounds, we were able, in a measure, to understand each other before we had gone far in the house-building operations, during which some of them were constantly beside me. One incident of that time was very memorable, and God turned it to good account for higher ends. I often tell it as the miracle of the speaking bit of wood, and it has happened to other missionaries exactly as to myself. While working at the house, I required some nails and tools. Lifting a piece of planed wood, I penciled a few words on it and requested our old chief to carry it to Mrs. Peyton, and she would send what I wanted. In blank wonder, he innocently stared at me and said, "But what do you want?" I replied, "The wood will tell her." He looked rather angry, thinking that I befooled him, and retorted, "Whoever heard of wood speaking?" By hard pleading, I succeeded in persuading him to go. He was amazed to see her looking at the wood and then fetching the needed articles. He brought back the bit of wood and eagerly made signs for an explanation. Chiefly in broken Tanese, I read to him the words and informed him that in the same way God spoke to us through his book. The will of God was written there, and by, when he learned to read, he would hear God speaking to him from its page, as Mrs. Peyton heard me from the bit of wood. A great desire was thus awakened in the poor man's soul to see the very word of God printed in his own language. He helped me to learn words and master ideas with growing enthusiasm. And when my work of translating portions of Holy Scripture began, his delight was unbounded and his help invaluable. The miracle of a speaking page was not less wonderful than that of speaking wood. One day, while building the house, an old inland chief and his three sons came to see us. Everything was to them full of wonder. After returning home, one of the sons fell sick, and the father at once blamed us and the worship, declaring that if the lad died, we should all be murdered in revenge. Well, by God's blessing and by our careful nursing and suitable medicine, he recovered and was spared. The old chief superstitiously wheeled round almost to another extreme. He became not only friendly but devoted to us. He attended the Sabbath services and listened to the Anitiamese teachers, and to my first attempts, partly in Tanese, translated by the orator Taya, or the chief Namake, and explained in our hearing to the people in their mother tongue. But on the heels of this, another calamity overtook us. So soon as two rooms of the mission house were roofed in, I hired the stoutest of the young men to carry our boxes thither. Two of them started off with a heavy box suspended on a pole from shoulder to shoulder, their usual custom. They were shortly after attacked with vomiting of blood, and one of them, an Aramangan, actually died. The father of the other swore that if his son did not get better, every soul at the mission house would be slain in revenge. But God mercifully restored him. As the boat landing was nearly 3/4 of a mile distant, and such a calamity recurring would be not only sorrowful in itself, but perilous in the extreme for us all, I steeped my wits, and with such crude materials as were at hand, I manufactured not only a handbarrow, but a wheelbarrow for the pressing emergencies of the time. In due course, I procured a more orthodox hand cart from the colonies and coaxed and bribed the natives to assist me in making a road for it. Now, perhaps the ghost of Macadam would shudder at the appearance of that road, but it has proved immensely useful ever since. Macadam, M-A-C-A-D-A-M, that's a type of road, right? Okay, let's move on to chapter 60. A City of God. When, in the course of years, everything had been completed to our taste, we lived practically in the midst of a beautiful village. The church, the school, the orphanage, the smithy and joiner's shop, the printing office, the banana and yam house, the cookhouse, and so on. All very humble indeed, but all standing sturdily up there among the orange trees and preaching the gospel of a higher civilization and of a better life for Aniwa. The little road leading to each door was laid with the white coral broken small. The fence around all shone fresh and clean with new paint. Order and taste were seen to be laws in the white man's new life, and several of the natives began diligently to follow our example. Many and strange were the arts which I had to try to practice, such as handling the adze, the mysteries of tenon and mortise, and other feats of skill. If a native wanted a fish hook or a piece of red calico to bind his long whipcord hair, he would carry me a block of coral or fetch me a beam. But continuous daily toil seemed to him a mean existence. The women were tempted by calico and beads for pay to assist in preparing the sugarcane leaf for thatch, gathering it in the plantations and tying it over reeds 4 or 6 feet long with strips of bark of pandanus leaf, leaving a long fringe hanging over on one side. How differently they acted when the gospel began to touch their hearts. They built their church and their schools then by their own free toil, rejoicing to labor without money or price, and they have ever since kept them in good repair for the service of the Lord, by their voluntary offerings of wood and sugarcane leaf and coral lime. The roof was firmly tied on and nailed, and thereon were laid the reeds, fringed with sugarcane leaf, row after row tied firmly to the wood. The ridge was bound down by coconut leaves, dexterously plaited from side to side and skewered to the ridge pole with hard wooden pins. And over all, a fresh storm roof was laid on yearly for the hurricane months, composed of folded coconut leaves, held down with planks of wood, and bound to the framework below, which, however, had to be removed again in April to save the sugarcane leaf from rotting beneath it. There you were snugly covered in, and your thatching good to last from 8 years to 10. That is, provided you were not caught in the sweep of a hurricane, before which trees went flying like straws, huts disappeared like autumn leaves, and your mission house, if left standing at all, was probably swept bare alike of roof and thatch at a single stroke. Well for you at such times if you have a good barometer indicating the approach of the storm. Better still, a large cellar like ours, 4 and 20 feet by 16, built round with solid coral blocks, where goods may be stored, and whereinto also all your household may creep for safety, while the tornado tosses your dwelling about and sets huge trees dancing around you. We had also to invent a lime kiln. This proved one of the hardest nuts of all that had to be cracked. The kind of coral required could be obtained only at one spot, about 3 miles distant. Lying at anchor in my boat, the natives dived into the sea, broke off with hammer and crowbar piece after piece, and brought it up to me till I had my load. We then carried it ashore and spread it out in the sun to be blistered there for 2 weeks or so. Having thus secured 20 or 30 boatloads, and had it duly conveyed round to the mission station, a huge pit was dug in the ground, dry wood piled in below, and green wood above to the height of several feet, and on the top of all the coral blocks were orderly laid. When the pile had burned for 7 or 10 days, the coral had been reduced to excellent lime, and the plasterwork made therefrom shone like marble. On one of these trips, the natives performed an extraordinary feat. The boat, with full load, was struck heavily by a wave, and the reef drove a hole in her side. Quick as thought, the crew were all in the sea, and to my amazement, bearing up the boat with their shoulder and one hand, while swimming and guiding us ashore with the other. And there on the land we were hauled up, and 4 weary days were spent fetching and carrying from the mission station every plank, tool, and nail necessary for her repair. Every boat for these seas ought to be built of cedar wood and copper fastened, which is by far the most economical in the end. And all houses should be built of wood, which is as full as possible of gum or resin, since the large white ants devour not only other softwoods, but even colonial blue gum trees, the hard coconut, and window sashes, chairs, and tables. Glancing back on all these toils, I rejoice that such exhausting demands are no longer made on our newly arrived missionaries. Houses, all ready for being set up, are now brought down from the colonies. Zinc roofs and other improvements have been introduced. The synod appoints a deputation to accompany the young missionary and plant the house along with himself at the station committed to his care. Precious strength is thus saved for higher uses, and not only property, but life itself is oftentimes preserved. I will close this chapter with an incident which, though it came to our knowledge only years afterwards, closely bears upon our settlement on Aniwa. At first we had no idea why they so determinedly refused us one site and fixed us to another of their own choice. But after the old chief, Namake, became a Christian, he one day addressed the Aniwan people in our hearing to this effect. When Missy came, we saw his boxes. We knew he had blankets and calico, axes and knives, fish hooks and all such things. We said, "Don't drive him off, else we will lose all these things. We will let him land, but we will force him to live on the sacred plot. Our gods will kill him, and we will divide all that he has amongst the men of Aniwa." But Missy built his house on our most sacred spot. He and his people lived there, and the gods did not strike. He planted bananas there, and we said, "Now, when they eat of these, they will all drop down dead, as our fathers assured us, if anyone ate fruit from that ground, except only our sacred men themselves." These bananas ripened, and they did eat them, and we kept watching for days and days, but no one died. And therefore, what we say, and what our fathers have said, is not true. Our gods cannot kill them. Their Jehovah God is stronger than the gods of Aniwa. I enforced old Namaki's appeal, telling them that, though they knew it not, it was the living and true and only God who had sent them every blessing which they possessed, and had at last sent us to teach them how to serve and love and please him. In wonder and silence they listened, while I tried to explain to them that Jesus, the Son of this God, had lived and died and gone to the Father to save them, and that he was now willing to take them by the hand and lead them through this life to glory and immortality together with himself. The old chief led them in prayer, a strange, dark, groping prayer, with streaks of heathenism coloring every thought and sentence, but still a heartbreaking prayer, as the cry of a soul, once a cannibal, but now being thrilled through and through with the first conscious pulsations of the Christ Spirit, throbbing into the words, "Father, Father, our Father." When these poor creatures began to wear a bit of calico or a kilt, it was an outward sign of a change, though yet far from civilization. And when they began to look up and pray to one whom they called Father, our Father, though they might be far, very far from the type of Christian that dubs itself respectable, my heart broke over them in tears of joy. And nothing will ever persuade me that there was not a divine heart in the heavens rejoicing too. Next time, chapter 61, The Religion of Revenge. The Religion of Revenge. Thank you for listening. And I do thank you for the notes that I get from time to time. I do like hearing from you. Contact me with questions and comments. or just to say hi at bob.j.faulkner.72@gmail.com. Faulkner is F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R. And look around the site. I do believe you'll find other things that will be beneficial to you. We've got great preachers here that I've read, Charles Spurgeon and many others, stories from the persecuted church of yesterday and today, Bible studies, and a lot more. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we get to talk again real soon. Bye-bye.